Hello and welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, D.C. If you give us the next hour, we will give you the top stories featured on our VOA Asia program over the past week, like this one.
This resolution ratchets up the pressure on North Korea even further, building on our last resolution, which included the strongest sanctions ever imposed on them.
The U.S. ambassador to China gave an exclusive interview to VOA.
There's a lot of big issues and challenges, the threat from North Korea, and both of us have been working on trying to get the Korean Peninsula denuclearized.
And it was China who brought Pakistan and Afghanistan to Beijing to talk.
Mutual benefits between Afghanistan and Pakistan not only serves the interests of the two neighbors, but also contribute to regional peace, stability, and development.
That is but a taste of the stories and features that await you on VOA Asia Weekend. North Korea's foreign ministry last Sunday called the latest United Nations sanctions an act of war that violate a grave infringement on its sovereignty. As VOA's Lori London told us, the statement followed a vote on Friday by the UN Security Council imposing another round of sanctions targeting sectors that fuel Pyongyang's illicit weapons program.
The latest sanctions were unanimously approved in response to North Korea's latest launch of a ballistic missile that it claims can reach anywhere on the U.S. mainland. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley says the United States will continue to match the Kim regime's choice of aggressive actions.
On November 29th, Pyongyang launched an intercontinental ballistic missile. This was another attempt by the Kim regime to masquerade as a great power while their people starve and their soldiers defect. But for the international community, this is an unprecedented challenge from a defiant state. So we have leveled an unprecedented response.
The resolution was drafted by the United States and negotiated with the North's closest ally, China. Haley says it builds on three earlier rounds of tough sanctions imposed on Pyongyang this year.
This resolution ratchets up the pressure on North Korea even further, building on our last resolution, which included the strongest sanctions ever imposed on them.
But Sunday's statement from North Korea challenged that assertion, saying it's a pipe dream for the United States to think it will give up its nuclear weapons. The resolution adopted by the Security Council includes sharply lower limits on North Korea's refined oil imports, the return home of all North Koreans working overseas within 24 months, and a crackdown on ships smuggling banned items, including coal and oil, to and from the country. UN Security Council President Koro Besho, in response to concerns that the tough new sanctions will hurt ordinary North Korean citizens who are already living under difficult conditions.
We are not trying to hurt the people of North Korea. We are pressuring the regime to change its policy. And as you said, we have clauses for exemption of for humanitarian needs. So I think that is very clear.
The North says countries that supported the new sanctions will be, quote, held completely responsible for all the consequences and will forever pay the price. Lori London, VOA News, Washington.
North Korea said it is a pipe dream for the United States to think it will give up its nuclear weapons and called the latest UN sanctions to target its country an act of war that violates its sovereignty. VOA's Steve Miller gathered together the elements that led to these latest sanctions.
John Hyland reports that North Korea has called the latest round of United Nations sanctions against it an act of war and tantamount to a complete economic blockade.
North Korea described the latest UN sanctions against it as an act of war on Sunday, saying it was tantamount to a complete economic blockade. In a statement, the country's foreign ministry threatened to punish those who supported the measure. The UN Security Council unanimously imposed new sanctions on Pyongyang on Friday, following its recent intercontinental ballistic missile test. The measures seek to limit the country's access to refined petroleum products and crude oil, with a near 90% ban. The UN also wants to curb earnings from abroad, with a demand for the repatriation of North Korean workers within 24 months. The US-drafted resolution, supported by longtime Pyongyang allies Russia and China, commits the Security Council to further sanctions if there's another nuclear test or ballistic missile launch. In November, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un declared the nuclear force complete after the test of the isolated nation's largest ever missile, which it said puts all of the United States within range. It denies its nuclear program is in contradiction of international law, but rather a self-defensive deterrence. The latest statement described Washington as getting, quote, more and more frenzied in moves to impose the harshest ever sanctions and pressure on the country.
That was reporter John Hyland. Russia's RIA news agency reports that Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called for the United States and North Korea to start negotiations on Monday. Both China and Russia have called for a so-called dual suspension or freeze-for-freeze option, which would call for the freezing of joint U.S. and South Korea military exercises while North Korea freezes its testing. Speaking at the United Nations earlier in December, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson responded to that suggestion.
We do not accept a freeze-for-freeze as a precondition to talks. We do not accept any relaxing of the sanctions regime as a precondition of talks. We do not accept the resumption of humanitarian assistance as a precondition of talks. So we are not going to accept preconditions for these talks. But as I indicated in my remarks, our communication channels remain open. North Korea knows they're open. They know where the door is. They know where to walk through that door when they want to talk.
Secretary Tillerson also said that North Korea's growing nuclear capabilities are a direct threat to the United States and that Washington will use all necessary measures to defend itself against such aggression.
Monday, the Chinese government urged countries to act with restraint and work to ease tensions after North Korea called the latest U.S. sanctions an act of war that violated its sovereignty. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said Monday that nations should exercise restraint and make positive and constructive efforts to de-escalate tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Beijing also asked all relevant parties to impose the latest sanctions in what they called a comprehensive and balanced manner. The U.N. Security Council unanimously approved tough new sanctions against North Korea on Friday in response to its latest launch of a ballistic missile that Pyongyang said could reach anywhere on the U.S. mainland. This is VOA Asia Weekend. The U.S. ambassador to China, Terry Branstad, applauded China's cooperation in pushing sanctions on North Korea, but said more effort should be made. In an exclusive interview with VOA's Mandarin reporter, Kala Yu, in Des Moines, Iowa, he also shared his views on other crucial issues between the United States and China, such as Taiwan, bilateral trade, and human rights.
Mr. Ambassador, in President Trump's national security strategy, he listed China as a rival and threat to the United States. And that's very different from what he said when he was visiting China. So I'm wondering, how do you see this relationship? Do you think the U.S.-China relationship has gone better or worse under President Trump?
Well, I think the chemistry between President Trump and President Xi Jinping is very good. They've had three meetings, Mar-a-Lago, the recent trade mission, of course, state visit to Beijing was outstanding. They also got together in Hamburg. They've had 10 telephone calls. And the president's granddaughter has spoken in Mandarin, and that's been very impressive to the people in China. So there's a lot of big issues and challenges, the threat from North Korea, and both of us have been working on trying to get the Korean Peninsula denuclearized. And I'm appreciative of the cooperation we've had from China in the UN Security Council resolutions and enforcing those sanctions. And so we also, the trade issue, we had over $250 billion in deals that were signed during the president's mission. And then we're working together on dealing with these dangerous drugs like fentanyl. So I think there's challenges, but there's good collaboration that's going on. I'm hopeful it's going to lead to more trade and a better economy for both China and America, but to really benefit the whole world.
We all understand that the nuclear crisis in North Korea is not only a threat to the U.S., but to China as well. And you have been to the China-North Korea border yourself. So do you think China has done enough in reining its neighbor? What more do you think China could do?
Supporting additional sanctions, and I think one of the areas that we're looking at is oil and also North Korean workers that are working in China. When I was in Jilin province, the party secretary told me there are 10,000 there in that province alone. So that is a source of money that's going to North Korea that's being used for this nuclear missile program. So I think that could be really helpful.
We know that China has responded very strongly to a possible visit of the U.S. warships to Taiwan. So I want to know, what is President Trump's stance on Taiwan, and how is that different than the previous administrations?
Well, I think President Trump has reiterated the United States supports the One China policy. That's been our policy for decades, and that hasn't changed. The United States has always provided support, and that's part of the Taiwan Act, that's been in place for a long time. So that's no change either.
What are some other issues that you really want to stress with the Chinese government during your tenure as ambassador?
Well, there's still concerns about human rights issues. We're concerned about Liu Xiaobo, who, you know, died in prison or in custody, and his widow and her being able to freely travel. So those are issues that we have brought to the attention of the Chinese leaders.
You've lived in Beijing for almost half a year now. How do you like it there?
Well, I just want to continue to get to all parts of China. My goal is to get to every province, meet as many people as possible, and I've been very proud of the cooperation that we've received and the warm welcome we've received in China. And I'm very honored and very proud to represent the United States in China.
And your grandchildren now live with you in China. How do they like it?
They love it, and they're learning Chinese. And they can sing a happy birthday in Chinese as well as in English and counting, and just 5 years old. That's pretty good.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for taking our interview.
U.S. Ambassador to China Terry Branstad speaking with VOA Mandarin reporter Calla Yu. As we continue on VOA Asia Weekend, young people come from all over the world to work in Silicon Valley, California. As these workers build a life away from home, many of them struggle with how to bring their aging parents to their new community. But what happens to foreign parents entering their later years in a new country? VOA's Deanna Mitchell visited a unique community in Silicon Valley that caters to retirees from India.
In India, many parents live with their children's families as they grow older. But in the United States, more people enter retirement communities designed to cater to older people's needs.
The children are so busy nowadays. So they are all the time working, taking care of their kids. So we don't want to interfere in their lives. So it is better to have independent living.
Asha Rao Rane moved directly to California from India to be closer to her family. She lives at Priya Living, a community created by Arun Paul.
In living here in America as the son of immigrants, I've realized that, you know, there's unique needs that immigrants have. I started this because I was thinking about, you know, what I could do for my parents.
A real estate developer by trade, Paul created Priya Living as an affinity living community, meaning it caters to people with similar interests, things like yoga and meditation. Residents like Uma Jindal say Priya has helped them continue living independently in a new place.
Daughter is going to work. Everybody's gone to work. You're sitting home by yourself. You know, here at least you are busy.
That old system was based on a different time when women were in the house taking care of, in many cultures, their husband's parents. And obviously the role of women in society has changed globally.
This is a community living.
All the time we are together. We are taking teas, we are having our food together, we go for a walk together. Nobody is lonely here.
Come and have chai.
We walked in and it instantly was like walking in to an Indian community in India. Even the building is painted the same color as so many of the buildings in India are painted.
In addition to daily socializing, residents say they also appreciate celebrating major Indian holidays like the Hindu Festival of Lights, Diwali.
All your customs, your festivals, you feel enjoyable when you see the same festive, you remember those things.
Most residents are from India, but not all. Carlos McCann is an 89-year-old World War II veteran. A retired Marine from Arkansas, McCann had been living in the same apartment before it was converted and didn't want to leave.
Location, location, location is everything, and the location here is the one I chose. I'm near my bank, I'm near the library, I'm near Barnes & Noble's bookstore, near Costco. Everything is sort of come together right here in this location. It's like this is the center of the world. It's the center of my world anyway.
This type of independent senior community was at first a shock to Nagendra Prasad and Manjula Nilakantaya, who are staying at Priya for 2 months while visiting their daughter, an intern at Google.
I mean, really, in the beginning, we were surprised. In India, usually the younger people, they take care of the aged people.
Our generation is older generation. We can change according to the needs of the new generation, our kids, but they cannot go backward. So it's we have to change ourselves first.
Residents say they have the best of both worlds, a supportive group of like-minded friends inside the community and their children and grandchildren just outside. Dina Mitchell, VOA News, Silicon Valley.
Once they find human neighborhoods, wild animals tend to stick around them. That's because of the free food buffet we tend to leave lying around in our trash and gardens. Short of killing the animals, it is nearly impossible to get rid of the unwanted guests. Until recently, that was the problem with baboons in one South African neighborhood, as VOA's Kevin Enochs discovered.
Once wild animals have gotten a taste of free human food, it's hard to make them go back to their natural diet. It may seem a bit funny to watch people chasing baboons out of their homes, but the reality is these baboons are likely hooked on human food. And their habit can cause some serious property damage. The Tokai suburb in the Western Cape used to have a big baboon problem.
There are a lot of them in Cape Town, and they come into your house and they make an awful mess and you've just got to live with it, but not too bad. They've been in my house quite often. But they're not aggressive. I don't find them aggressive. And they're not really interested in you. They're looking for food. That's what they're looking for.
Despite public campaigns urging people to not feed them, these adaptable primates find a way.
We've had such a bad dose of baboons going on in our little area just below the mountain here. So we made a little social media group among all the neighborhoods here just to warn everybody. Baboons in 3rd Street, baboons on the roof here, baboons attacking the flower pots there, so that everybody could be a little bit warned.
In the past, baboons with a taste for human food might have been killed.
Chacma baboons have largely been considered as vermin for many hundreds of years in management, and people typically have always felt that the only way to deal with vermin animals is through lethal methods of management, so that is to kill them. So this has only changed fairly recently where people are trying other adaptive methods of management.
And in this case, that management involves fooling the baboons into thinking this is dangerous territory. These are the sounds of baboon predators, and it sends the primates running.
You play calls, pretending that there are predators there, alarm calls, sounds of predators, sounds of animals being killed. They're scared to go there, and they avoid the area.
So far, this virtual sonic fence is working.
We've had like literally no baboons for the last 2 weeks, so we've all been saying, is it our imagination or are there suddenly no baboons? But there are suddenly no baboons.
But wildlife experts caution there's no one solution because baboons are so smart.
Baboons are so adaptable, the wildlife is so unpredictable. It's about having a toolbox approach.
Still, the Wildlife Solutions Group is reporting a 100% success rate over the past 18 months, and they are expanding their business into other neighborhoods. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. The United Nations General Assembly on Sunday heard arguments over a proposal to urge Myanmar to end a military campaign against Muslim Rohingya and called for the appointment of a UN special envoy. The resolution was put forward by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, a measure opposed from the start by Russia and China. The resolution called on the government to allow access for aid workers to ensure the return of all refugees and granting full citizenship rights to the Rohingya. Prior to the vote in the General Assembly, Myanmar's UN ambassador, Haldo Swan, lashed into the draft resolution, describing it as subjective, politically motivated, and corrupted, with the blatant intention of exerting unwarranted political pressure on Myanmar. He also said Naypyidaw was concerned with the intensified orchestrated demonization of Myanmar's government and its security forces, and he added that the resolution merely represented the attempt of some countries to abuse the United Nations to impose their political agenda on Myanmar.
The continuing provocative actions, the chorus of incitement, inflammatory rhetoric, and biased media portrayal of the issue of Rakhine State must be stopped to de-escalate tension and to bring back normalcy to the lives of all communities in the affected areas.
Swan said the resolution would not contribute to solving the humanitarian issues in the country's Rakhine State and stressed the Myanmar government's desire to bring peace, harmony, and development to the region.
The present draft resolution in question represents nothing but an evidence of the attempt by some countries to abuse the United Nations to impose their political agenda on Myanmar. The draft resolution will not contribute to solving the current humanitarian problem or the complex issues of Rakhine State. Exerting undue political pressure and coercive measures will only bring negative results and exacerbate the situation on the ground.
The vote was then taken. 10 nations voted against the resolution, with 122 voting in favor and 24 abstentions.
Draft Resolution 5 is adopted.
Many Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh facing diminished income are supplementing their needs with work in the camps. Steve Sanford talks to a few young and old entrepreneurs who have set up new businesses in the refugee zones.
The winter season has arrived for more than 650,000 Rohingya refugees who have fled a brutal crackdown by Myanmar forces in the last 4 months. Supply chains for food and shelter are slowly getting organized, but the wait is long and supplies are short for those with big families of more than eight.
They give us 10 or 12 kilograms of rice, but it is not enough. That is what they give us every month, but I've not gotten more than 10 kilograms of rice.
The World Food Program has delivered more than 20,000 metric tons of rice to 185,000 households, but admits it's not enough.
We're actually looking at targeting families and family size much more clearly. So we will look at increasing the ration size for a family of 4 to 6, and also those who are 8 plus will also get double. We need to address the need of people telling us we're hungry, we don't have enough food.
A recent camp survey from rights group Medicine Sans Frontier reports at least 6,700 Rohingya were killed during the attacks in Myanmar, and satellite imagery shows 40 more villages with building destruction in November, bringing the total to 354. As the evidence mounts, the consensus among most experienced crisis workers is not a surprise.
Having gone through all these traumatic situations, you know, seeing their brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers killed in front of them, and being raped, it is not appropriate according to the communities to return immediately.
As of December, the total number of refugees in the camps stands at nearly 860,000, including those who came before the most recent crackdown. And refugees like Mohammed Omar don't show any signs of packing for home.
We won't go back to Myanmar easily unless we get our rights. If we go there, they will cut us and kill us and shoot us, so we won't go back yet.
The Myanmar government has long denied allegations of atrocities against the Rohingya, but it is not clear when or if the Muslim minority group will be able to return. Meanwhile, the humanitarian crisis in the refugee camps is likely to continue well into 2018. Steve Sanford reporting from Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
There was widespread attention paid to Myanmar this past week as the government there was expected to make its decision on what the fate would be of two reporters working for the Reuters news service. VOA Asia's David Byrd had the story Thursday.
A court in Myanmar has extended the detention of two Reuters journalists for at least two more weeks. Walone and Cho So-woo were arrested December 12th, allegedly for possessing secret important papers. The area around the court was packed with journalists, police, and government officials as the two men emerged from a police van. Walone said the two men had just been carrying out their jobs as journalists and have never violated journalistic ethics. Cho So-woo said that whatever they were working on, they followed media ethics and no one can arrest journalists like this. Walone's wife said that she wanted her husband to be free soon and that he would never violate the rules of law. She said, I want my husband to be free soon, and I trust in him that he would never violate the rules of law. He has good morals, and I trust him, so he should be free soon. The two reporters were arrested for violating a British colonial-era law called the Official Secrets Act, which is punishable by up to 14 years in prison. They had allegedly acquired what the government calls important secret papers from two police officers who had been working in Rakhine State, the site of the Myanmar military's crackdown on ethnic Rohingyas. The brutal crackdown started in August in response to attacks on police outposts. The military response has been condemned as ethnic cleansing by the UN and has led to more than 650,000 Rohingyas fleeing to neighboring Bangladesh. Meanwhile, a spokesman for Myanmar's de facto civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, says the country is saddened by a U.S. decision to sanction a military commander linked to abuses against the Rohingya minority. The Trump administration announced December 21st that it is sanctioning General Maung Maung So, who was in charge of a crackdown on the Rohingya in Rakhine State. The United States said American officials had examined credible evidence of Maung Maung So's activities, including allegations against Burmese security forces of extrajudicial killings, sexual violence, and arbitrary arrest, as well as the widespread burning of villages. The military and the civilian government of Aung San Suu Kyi have denied allegations of widespread abuse in Rakhine.
A new report by the United Nations Children's Fund finds 2017 has been a particularly brutal year for children caught in conflict, as children around the world have been subject to shocking levels of attacks by warring parties. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says there is no safe place for children caught in conflict. The report finds children are being targeted and exposed to attacks and brutal violence in their homes, schools, and playgrounds. This in blatant disregard of international laws established to protect the most vulnerable. The report presents a numbing catalog of abuse and conflicts around the world, in Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and even in Europe, in eastern Ukraine. It reports children are deliberately targeted, used as human shields, killed, maimed, and recruited to fight. Children are raped, forced into marriage, abducted, and enslaved, and UNICEF says the physical and mental impact of this brutality upon children is unbearable and deeply traumatic. This video of Rohingya refugees on a riverbank in Bangladesh, newly arrived after fleeing violence in Myanmar, is heartrending. It shows groups of weeping children and a severely malnourished baby treated by a UNICEF doctor. With the right nutrition, some of these starving children will survive, but many others will not. The report details the direct and indirect price children are paying in several African conflicts. It notes a dramatic increase in violence in Central African Republic has led to children being killed, raped, abducted, and recruited by armed groups. It notes 850,000 children have been driven from their homes in the Kasai region of Democratic Republic of Congo. More than 19,000 children have been recruited as soldiers by armed groups in South Sudan. And in northeast Nigeria and Cameroon, at least 135 children have been used as suicide bombers. UNICEF says children are killed, maimed, denied access to food and water, and pushed to the limits of suffering from malnutrition, disease, and trauma. It says this happens in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and other conflicts where the rights and needs of children are violated with impunity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Stay with us. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend from the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscast. Every hour, on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Authorities in Xinjiang province in western China launched what they called a New Relatives Week program this month, which requires local civil servants to spend a week with Uyghur families in rural areas by the year's end. However, as VOA's Doug Bernard told us, the ethnic Uyghurs do not see the time as warming relations between them and the majority Han Chinese.
Beginning December 11th, thousands from the northwestern province traveled to the countryside and lodged with Uyghur families for a week-long stay of eating, drinking, and forming a family bond with members of the ethnic group, according to state media. While a percentage of those may be ethnic Uyghurs or distant relatives to Uyghurs, observers say many are still Han people from local government departments, public schools, or the judiciary. Uyghurs have no choice but to take in the participants, who also serve as the authorities' mouthpiece to hold home-based propaganda sessions and preach about the so-called spirits of China's 19th National Congress, following the twice-per-decade meeting, which was wrapped up in late October. Adrian Zentz, a German-based researcher, called the Relatives Week an intensified, intrusive measure. But he said it's nothing new, as similar security and social controls have been in place before.
So it's obviously surveillance. But they are looking to gather information, obviously look for signs of trouble, of what is defined as extremism, etc.
Prior to this, tens of thousands in Xinjiang were sent to live in the villages, people who Zentz said helped the local government have a better grasp of any potential racial unrest among the ethnic group. The researcher added that the security in Xinjiang is getting tighter than ever. A recent Wall Street Journal report described the capital city of Xinjiang as one of the most closely surveilled places on Earth, where citizens and visitors, quote, alike must run a gauntlet of police checkpoints, surveillance cameras, and machines scanning their ID cards, faces, eyeballs, and sometimes even entire bodies. Zentz said these stepped-up securitization and policing strategies may have enjoyed a short-term success, but will provide unsustainable in the long run, as they bear both economic and interracial risks, as well as the alienation of the local Han population.
The maintenance of very high pressure and stress over long periods of time is creating a strong liability, a strong risk in the long term. The pressure of the securitization is felt by everybody. It's also impacting the Han. And the Han in Xinjiang are very important for the government. And so alienating them is a major risk.
Online comments toward the new Relatives Week program are mostly favorable, although some sound slightly sarcastic. For reporter Joyce Huang, I'm Doug Bernard.
As winter sets in, the United Nations Refugee Agency plans to distribute aid to more than 2,700 needy families and internally displaced people, or IDPs, in the western Afghan province of Herat. Many of the displaced come from nearby Afghan provinces where ongoing fighting and insecurity have made it impossible to remain in their homes. John Walker narrates this report by Khalil Noorzai on their plight from a camp in Herat City.
The challenges are almost too many to count for those who have fled violence near their homes and sought shelter here in Herat City.
I have so many problems. I don't have a place to live, and I have two handicapped sons who can't work, so I have to work to make a living.
In hopes of providing some relief, the United Nations and local Afghan officials launched a winter distribution program on December 17th, giving money and supplies to nearly 3,000 families who are either internally displaced people, IDPs, or have been repatriated to Afghanistan.
The program also provides aid to Herat's needy families, as well as people with special needs.
$200 and 4 blankets are provided to every family. Afghan officials say the government will try to grant plots of land to people so they can build homes for themselves.
All IDPs will receive a land lot. The most vulnerable IDPs, including women and children, will receive special attention.
Some of the displaced who have received aid say living conditions here are harsh and that the help will not last long, especially during the winter season.
My only son, who was the breadwinner and was serving in Afghanistan Army in Qalaynaw, capital of Badghis province, was killed in service. My husband can hardly make a living for our family.
Others are calling on the government to bring peace to their provinces so they can return home.
The government should provide security in our villages and provinces so we can go back to our farms, start farming, and make a living. We are living a refugee life inside our own country.
The Herat Provincial Department of Refugees and Repatriations says more than 14,000 refugees, including 10,000 IDPs, are living in various camps and shelters in Herat. For Khalil Noorzai in Herat, I'm John Walker, VOA News.
Chinese diplomacy apparently has succeeded in persuading Afghanistan to begin a wide-ranging dialogue proposed by Pakistan for mending strained bilateral relations. The decision came at Tuesday's first trilateral talks hosted by Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi between his Pakistani and Afghan counterparts. Last month, Islamabad shared with Kabul what is called an Afghanistan-Pakistan Action Plan for Solidarity, or APAPS, for a constructive and meaningful engagement between the two countries. This proposed plan, say officials, would create working groups in politics, economics, the military, intelligence sharing, and issues related to Afghan refugees in Pakistan. Pakistan's foreign minister, Khwaja Asif, told a joint news conference at the trilateral talks that there is a response now from our brothers in Afghanistan.
Pakistan emphasized the importance of border management, return of Afghan refugees, and intelligence sharing for effective counterterrorism cooperation. We look forward to response to our proposal for the Afghan-Pakistan Action Plan for Solidarity and for early operationalization of 5 working groups.
Asif said, I think things will start moving on the formation of the 5 groups on different topics entailed in this proposal, and there will be progress on the proposal. Asif didn't elaborate and credited China for the headway made on the proposed dialogue with Kabul. Without directly commenting on remarks made by his Pakistani counterpart, the Afghan foreign minister, Salahuddin Rabbani, praised Beijing for arranging Tuesday's dialogue and said that China has very good relations with both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Afghanistan firmly believes that improving state-to-state relations, enhancing mutual trust, and utilizing opportunities for deepening cooperation on the basis of mutual respect and mutual benefits between Afghanistan and Pakistan not only serves the interests of the two neighbors, but also contribute to regional peace, stability, and development.
Rabbani added that Afghanistan will host the second round of the three-way meeting in the first half of next year, and we hope that we will make more progress, he said. We now welcome VOA's Ayaz Gul to VOA Asia. Our longtime Pakistan correspondent is in Islamabad. Ayaz, several other stories are making headlines around the world. I'll leave it for you to explain it all.
All of the developments that have taken place over the past 24 hours are very important and reflect the kind of tensions that have been gripping South Asia, particularly the India-Pakistan region. And the most important development happened a day earlier when Pakistan arranged a meeting of an Indian death row prisoner, Kulbhushan Yadav, who was arrested in Pakistan a year ago, and then he was tried for espionage and organizing terrorism against Pakistan. But for the first time, at the request of his family, through the diplomatic channels that India used, Pakistan issued visas to Kulbhushan Yadav's wife and his mother, and they arrived in Islamabad, and a special meeting was arranged, obviously under the supervision of Pakistani officials, although there was an Indian diplomat standing there, but he wasn't able to listen to the conversation that Kulbhushan Yadav had with his wife and mother, but he could see them, and that is how Pakistanis defended this whole situation, that because Kulbhushan Yadav has been sentenced to death and that he has been involved in acts of terrorism against Pakistan, so there was no provision under any diplomatic understanding that would allow a consular access for India to meet this guy. So in order to protect its own interests, Pakistanis made sure that only the family of this convict, Kulbhushan Yadav, meets him. But then we obviously saw a reaction. This is how the Indian Foreign Minister, Sushma Swaraj, reacted to the meeting that happened here in Islamabad a day earlier.
The Pakistani press was allowed on multiple occasions to approach family members closely, harass and hector them, and hurt false and motivated accusations about Sri Yadav. This was despite a clear agreement that the media would not be allowed close access.
But while this, as you know, while this meeting was taking place, just hours after this meeting took place on Monday, Pakistani military issued a statement that Indian border forces along the de facto border in Kashmir opened fire at a Pakistani security outpost and killed three soldiers and wounded one more. And Pakistan complained. Obviously, today they summoned the Indian Deputy High Commissioner to the Foreign Ministry, and a protest was formally lodged, where the Pakistani officials insisted that while Islamabad demonstrated this goodwill gesture by allowing the family of Kulbhushan Yadav to meet him, India responded by initiating unprovoked firing across the Kashmir border and killed these three soldiers. But then there is a reason for the Indians to defend their action, and they did openly defended their action, because 2 days earlier it was New Delhi which came out and protested and said that Pakistani border forces in Kashmir, in the same region, initiated fire in violation of a so-called ceasefire in the Himalayan region and killed four Indian soldiers, including a senior officer. And apparently what happened to the Pakistani soldiers was a revenge attack from the Indian side.
Ayaz, you've been covering this for many a year, and nothing seems to change as far as the tensions between Pakistan and India are concerned.
Well, that is the sad part of this whole story, and there is no hope that this issue is going to be resolved. In fact, as a result of these current skirmishes and clashes on the border, there are serious worries that they can escalate into a major conflict between the two countries. And the these three wars that Pakistan and India have fought over the last 60, 70 years were conventional wars. But since then, since the last war that was in 1971, both the countries have achieved nuclear capabilities, and they are now armed with nuclear weapons. And the fear is that any future conflict, even if it is a conventional conflict, is likely to escalate into a nuclear exchange. And that is why there's a lot of worry, but we don't see any hope that the two countries are any closer to even resuming some kind of diplomatic negotiation.
Ayaz Gould, our longtime Pakistan correspondent, is in Islamabad atop a lake covered by thick ice. Fishermen in northeastern China cast out the first net for this year's Winter Fishing Festival. It is an ancient yearly tradition that these days is as much an international spectator sport as it is a source of food. Arash Arabasadi has more.
On a frozen lake in China, fishermen gather for an annual winter fishing festival said to be 1,000 years old. The fire ritual is for good luck in catching the fish swimming below the ice. Fishermen say that choosing the right spot to cast the giant 3,000-meter net is critical to the hunt.
Looking at the lake, the low-lying area is bigger, with larger water depth and more bubbles. It must have many fish here.
Hours pass, and the fishermen tighten their net, pulling up around 100,000 kilograms of fish. The fishermen scoop them from the net while visitors look on.
I'm an owner of a restaurant, and I'm here choosing some great fish. We all know fish here at the Linhuan Lake are good. On the first day of winter fishing, many customers have pre-ordered fish.
The caught fish are stored in a glass enclosure, and fishermen in this northeastern region say they'll cast the net through the middle of January. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
In 2017, China's Xi Jinping rose to become the country's most powerful leader in decades. And as he shoulders more responsibility, analysts say the government in Beijing is likely to take more risks in 2018 at home and overseas, even as it deals with economic challenges at home, a nuclear North Korea, and the looming threat of trade tensions with the United States. VOA's Beijing Bureau Chief Bill Ide has this report.
Xi Jinping is the core leader of the Communist Party, and like Mao Zedong, his name and political thought is now written into the party's constitution. As head of the world's second-largest economy, he is leading a push to sell what he calls the China Solution, Beijing's effort to help solve the world's financial and political uncertainties. In 2018, analysts such as David Kelly, head of research at the Beijing-based group China Policy, see him continuing to seize opportunities overseas as they arise.
There's a window of opportunity internationally created by the Trump administration and Brexit and a few other things, Middle East. And there's been, despite the risks seen, for example, in Pakistan with a building of ports and infrastructure, they basically doubled down.
The thinking among China's Communist Party leadership, Kelly adds, is that now is the time to act. China's trillion-dollar strategic and trade program, the Belt and Road Initiative, includes projects like a multi-billion-dollar deep-sea port in Gwadar, Pakistan, and an economic corridor through that country, which is plagued by terrorist threats. But there has been pushback there against the program in Pakistan, as well as other Chinese policies in the region. Beijing's military expansion of man-made islands continues in the South China Sea, but China is also showing flexibility as it works on a code of conduct, analysts say. Yang Kaihuang, a political science professor at Taiwan's Mingquan University, says Beijing's approach is both principled and flexible. Yang says countries including China have to get used to different levels of engagement in many different aspects with the prioritized goal of avoiding major conflicts and wars. Yang says the world including China has come to that common understanding. North Korea remains a huge uncertainty for China, where Beijing has shown an ability over the past year to take riskier moves, such as adopting tougher sanctions, as Pyongyang continues to test the international community. This has meant working closer at times with Washington, even as the threat of a possible trade war with the United States looms overhead. China Policy's Kelly says there is much uncertainty. And even more challenging than China's own fault lines is the Trump administration, he adds.
If you've got risk economics and risky politics together, then you don't just have two times the risk, you've got the risk squared.
At home, Xi's power also brings opportunities and risk as well. With his increased power and general sense that he was successful during his first 5 years in office, expectations from the public and the risk of failure will both be higher, Yang says. Yang says if those in Xi's leadership team make mistakes or handle issues inappropriately, the public will feel that he has not made good choices, and he'll bear complete responsibility. A recent uproar over the forced eviction of migrant workers in Beijing and backlash over a plan to force residents in the northeast to shift away from coal in the cold of winter, even before much of the infrastructure was finished, are two recent examples. Analysts say that while cronies of Xi, such as Beijing's party secretary Tai Chi, managed to wiggle out of those challenges largely unscathed, both highlight how the stakes and expectations are higher. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Stay with us. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend from the Voice of America. There's a good chance that 2017 will go down in the history of medicine as a year when genetic engineering finally started moving from research labs into clinics. Several successful stories coming from different parts of the world promise that hereditary diseases and cancers may soon be conquered. VOA's George Putich took a look back at a few of these cases.
Amazing grace.
17-year-old Christian Guardino from Long Island is a celebrated semifinalist in the TV reality show America's Got Talent. But he's also famous for something even more important. Due to a congenital disease, Christian lost his eyesight at a very young age. Using gene editing, doctors at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia managed to repair the faulty gene, not only for Christian, but for other patients.
When the correct copy of the gene is delivered to their retinas, they can begin to see.
Editing the long strands of DNA molecules that form our genetic picture involves inserting a harmless virus that contains the corrective gene into the affected tissue, in this case, the retina. As retina cells multiply, the corrective gene spreads out and slowly repairs all other cells. Doctors from Italy and Germany used the combination of gene editing and stem cell therapy to save the life of a Syrian boy suffering from a debilitating genetic skin disease that caused constant painful blisters and open sores. Doctors took a small piece of the boy's skin, altered it to correct the genetic flaw, combined it with stem cells, and grew new skin that was grafted onto the boy's body, eventually replacing most of his damaged skin.
This kid is back to his normal life again. That's what we dreamed of doing, and it was possible.
At 44, Brian Madeau is among the oldest survivors of a rare genetic syndrome that typically kills patients much earlier.
I've lived so long that I'm pretty happy I've gotten this far.
Using a tool called CRISPR, doctors repaired the defective genes in some of Madeau's liver cells and injected them into his blood. When the repaired cells reached his liver, they transferred the changes to other cells in a fix that appears to be permanent. Critics say that gene therapies are very expensive and success stories are infrequent, but researchers are optimistic that permanent cures for many hereditary diseases are now within reach. George Putich, VOA News.
Coastal communities around the world depend on coral reefs for food, storm protection, and tourism, but many reefs are suffering under the onslaught of climate change. Scientists are fighting back, however. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Off the coast of Miami, divers are staking twigs of coral to the ocean bottom. These twigs were clipped from the University of Miami's coral nursery. Scientists working to restore degraded reefs recently discovered that corals grow faster when they're cut into smaller pieces, says project manager Dalton Hesley.
We can take a large boulder coral, fragment it into a lot of small coin-sized pieces, increase their growth, and then fuse them back together to create a larger coral colony than we started with in a fraction of the time.
Branching corals like these work especially well. Hesley says the lab started 9 years ago with 30 finger-sized fragments.
We've turned those into over 3,500 in our coral nurseries. That means any day of the week we can collect hundreds of these staghorn and elkhorn corals to transplant onto local reefs as a natural way to promote growth and recovery.
The group has transplanted more than 11,000 corals so far. But those corals face the same warming oceans that are killing reefs in many parts of the world. Hesley's group does not want their efforts to go to waste. That's why they're working with their University of Miami colleague, Andrew Baker.
So that instead of planting out the next set of coral victims, we're actually planting out corals that we think are going to be more heat tolerant in the future.
Corals get their food and their bright colors from algae partners called symbionts. But when the water gets too warm, they lose the algae. These bleached corals cannot live for long. But, Baker adds,
it actually provides an opportunity for corals to potentially change their algal symbionts and become sort of colonized by new types of algae that are maybe more suited to the new environment.
Baker's lab is stressing out corals and selecting the ones that recover best.
Despite having been really severely bleached just a couple of months ago, they've actually recovered really well, and you can see that they've started to grow new branches.
The next step will be to plant stress-hardened corals on degraded reefs and see how they do. The team is optimistic that they can give the reefs a fighting chance, but they know there's only so much they can do.
We can't rebuild every reef around the globe, so that's why education is the second biggest part of our program and our efforts.
They recruit volunteers to help rebuild the reefs. They teach them about the need for global solutions to climate change, and they hope these citizen scientists will help spread the word. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Miami.
A top Chinese drug enforcement official Thursday said the United States needs to do more to fight its opioid epidemic. The division director of the Chinese Ministry of Public Security's Narcotics Control Bureau also told reporters in Beijing that there was little evidence showing China was the source of many of the chemicals used in the production of the powerful opioid fentanyl. Yuhai Bin, the division director at the Chinese Ministry of Public Security's Narcotics and Control Bureau, said China has never denied the fact that some of the materials for making fentanyl are exported to the U.S. from China, but indeed we do not have sufficient information and evidence on the amount and the ratio to illustrate the exact situation. Chinese and U.S. authorities have worked closely to advance international drug enforcement regulations and slow the flow of drug precursors into the United States. However, the two governments have also squabbled over how much blame rests with each country. The Australian Federal Police, the AFP, have released a comedy parody of the 12 Days of Christmas Carol to celebrate their successes against drug gangs this year. It comes as the AFP announced the seizure of a record consignment of methamphetamine from Sydney. Phil Mercer has more.
All throughout this year, the AFP has seized drugs in washing powder, ice in a light plane, meth in protein powder, liquid ice in water.
What?
The AFP posted its parody Christmas video on Facebook. It says that drug traffickers and organised criminal gangs have been no match for its crack team of elves, which has found consignments in some unusual places.
Drugs in someone's bowels.
Yuck!
The role of the Australian Federal Police is to combat transnational and organised crime. Its festive video has gone viral.
If you have information about a possible drug importation, call Santa on 1-800-333-000 to have them put on the naughty list.
And we're looking forward to 2018.
Santa's coming to town.
Santa! Oh my God!
And the serious work continues. The AFP said Friday it had seized Australia's biggest ever haul of methamphetamine. Authorities believe the consignment came from China. Eight men have been charged. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you for spending some time with us listening to this week's episode of VOA Asia Weekend. Please join us next week. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, D.C. From all of us in VOA Asia, Jim Stevenson, David Byrd, Skylar Ogden, and our esteemed managing editor, Diane Gao, may you have the happiest New Year.